And to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart, that is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for the Washington Post, and they are in person here with
here.
Me. I can touch you, actually, in the studio. This is exciting. I've got to figure out how I'm going to get through this conversation.
So weird to be doing it while wearing shoes.
Exactly. Instead of our house slippers. So much to talk about. And Jonathan, let's just quickly pick up with where Dan Bush left off. Texas, really important decisions for them to make about these new districts. They've got to figure out how to draw those lines. What is at stake here? With the Congress so evenly divided, what's at stake here?
What's at stake here is the majority for the Congress. Whether the Democrats will maintain their very slim majority, or as a result of redistricting, not just in Texas, but around the country, whether the lines will be drawn in such a way that gives an advantage to Republicans going into the 2022 midterms before a vote has even been cast. And, you know, with Texas, the influx of people, their population growing, a lot of them in the urban centers that went for Democratic candidates, and yet the way the districts can be drawn, that voting power very well might end up resulting in districts that would be drawn for Republicans to do better in.
So how can Democrats counter this, David? I mean, how do you see this shaking out, given what's going on in Washington?
Yeah, I think prayer would help. I think, you know, the Democrats I talk to want to maintain the House. They don't expect to. Somebody said it would take a miracle. Miracles could happen, and it could happen. But, in midterm elections, when one party controls both houses of Congress and the White House, then their records in these first midterms tends to be terrible. And then there's the population shift, which we've been hearing about. That by itself is probably enough to get the Republicans 4, 5, 6, 7 seats. And then there's the redrawing of the lines, and Republicans just control a lot more state legislatures. Now, I should say, I'm more focused on population shifts than on gerrymandering, because while I think these lines, the legislatures draw are gross and unwieldy, and it's the politicians selecting the voters, I don't think the effect is that big. In the middle of the 20th century, you had a big effect where Democrats had a natural advantage because of the way they drew the lines. Then in the early 20th century, the Republicans had a pretty big effect, maybe 20 more seats than you would think from their vote totals. But recently, it's been a pretty small effect. It's been in the single digits. So, and that's in part because half the states, it's not partisanly drawn.
For different reasons.
But what we have happening here is it's not just redistricting. We have what I call a perfect storm brewing. You've got redistricting on top of voter laws that have been voted into Georgia, Florida. Texas Democrats did a dramatic move to keep their law from going into effect, but a special session will be called, and those laws might well go through. Iowa, Arizona. And so those laws are being put in place. You know, Democrats call them voter suppression laws. They will keep people, primarily black and brown people, the young, from getting out to vote. Not every eligible voter will be able to vote, and not every legally cast vote might not be counted. And that's what's in danger as well.
And all this getting more attention usually. I mean, waiting for census data, waiting to see what each state does, certainly in the spotlight. Let's turn, David, to our lead tonight, and that is President Biden in Europe, meeting with the British Prime Minister, meeting with his counterparts in the so-called G7. Why does this trip matter for him? What does he need to do?
Well, he needs to show that America is back, you know, and back and cooperating with people. And, you know, I've traveled on delegations he's made to Munich to the security conference they have there. And what you see is he's on first-name basis with everybody. Like with the world leaders, with the doorman in the hotel, he's been doing it for so long. And so I think there's a little of that personal diplomacy. I think they're proudest of the fact they got this vaccine thing done. I spoke to a White House official today, and they said the last 4 weeks have really been a sprint to get this so we could offer half a billion vaccines and get our allies to do another half a billion. And that'll all be done by the middle of the next year. And so they're surprised they could get to this. They thought we would not be in a state where we had so many vaccines. We would have enough to buy and then share with the world. And I think they want to show that we're in the generosity business again, and that America can be a generous nation in the world, a little Marshall Plan. And I think they'd love to get to a spot where it's not a nation-by-nation fight against COVID. It's a little more of an interdependent global fight against COVID. And so they're pleased with that. They're under no illusions that American-European relations are going to go back to the way they used to be in the Cold War. That's not going to happen. But they're very pleased, and I think legitimately so.
How do you see the way? What is at stake for Biden and his agenda here and globally?
Well, I think, you know, to your point, the president knows all of these people. He was a senator for 36 years, vice president for 8 years. Yes, he is on a first-name basis. His mantra is, America is back. But, you know, there's a piece in, I think it was the Times of London, asking the question, okay, you know, but do the words match the deeds? And I do think that there's some skepticism in Europe about whether the president's focus on China, whether that's taking attention away from them, whether the President Biden is continuing former President Trump's policies vis-a-vis China, think of tariffs.
Yes.
And then other things that President Biden is doing that former President Trump talked about, withdrawing from Afghanistan. So I think what we're seeing, yeah, it's not going to go back to the way it was. And I do think that the world now is like, they're happy the United States is back in the fold. But I think they've figured out over the last 4 years, we can't really depend on the United States, especially when it comes to President Biden's mantra is also democracy. We have to show that democracy works. But those world leaders are watching what we're doing here, the last conversation we had about voting rights. How can you have a democracy if voting rights are at risk?
So it's David, it's the pandemic that has shifted the landscape, of course, but it's also the 4 years of Donald Trump.
Yeah, of PTSD, they've got whatever post-traumatic Trump is. You know, they wonder if this 4 years is an interregnum and that Trump will be back. They wonder if the Trump-like figure will be back. And so there's some sense America's fundamentally less stable. And then we are more America first. I mean, Biden is not as America first as Trump was. But, you know, you look at our purchasing decisions as a government, it's America first. And we're just living in a world where multilateral cooperation is less emphasized, frankly, from a lot of countries all at once. And that has just been a trend of the last 25 years as nationalism has become a stronger force in the world and across the West than in Asia. And somehow there's just been a deterioration in our willingness to cooperate on a whole range of fronts.
Harder, in other words, Jonathan, I hear you saying this is harder than one might have expected coming out of Trump and President Trump and assuming everything was going to be easier for President Biden globally.
Right, harder, but I think from President Biden's perspective, for someone who knows all of these people, I think he's counting on and banking on the fact that those relationships will help smooth over some of the harder things that they have to deal with. And you know what? If I were President Biden, I would, you know, think that my chances, my odds were good. Yeah, not great, but good.
We've been on a lot of calls with Biden administration officials, and they're weirdly normal. It's like democracy's in crisis, the world's falling apart. But they're like, as if it's like 1955. It's like, you know, everything, we'll cooperate, we'll compromise, we'll have these civil discussions. And I don't know if they're just putting that face on that we live in a normal world anymore, but they're very normal.
I think they would probably say, yeah, they are very normal. But what I take from that is, you know what, these are people who are competent. You know, they've been in these jobs before, they know what the pitfalls are, and they also know that everything is on fire, but at least they know the terrain.
Well, speaking of everything being on fire, David, in the last few days we've learned that the Trump administration was trying in a number of ways that we find now surprising to seize data from not just journalists, and that's been in the news, but Democratic members of Congress going after their cell phone records, the data, their family members, even children. We've now got an investigation underway. What does this tell us about what was going on under President Trump?
Yeah, the Trump Justice Department keeps looking worse and worse, even more worse than it was when it was in office. I mean, you know, when there's a leak of confidential information, there's going to be an investigation. We understand that. But they tried an investigation. They didn't dig up anything on the people they wanted to get, Adam Schiff and people like that. And so they relaunched another investigation using extremely aggressive means. And, you know, prosecutors or investigators have some discretion over how aggressive they're going to be. And I would say they got so aggressive, not only so aggressive that it's super invasive to those of us in the media and people in Congress, but it just looks like a political witch hunt. And Donald Trump is out there in public saying Adam Schiff should be investigated. And lo and behold, the people in the Justice Department take political orders. And that's not what they're supposed to do. The Justice Department, it's never pure, but it's always supposed to be a step removed from politics so we have some sense of justice.
Is this something, Jonathan, that President Trump can be held accountable for ultimately?
I mean that I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I can't see, as much as everyone, and I shouldn't say everyone, a lot of Democrats and people who had a lot of problems with Donald Trump, they would love to be able to say, this is what's going to take him down, meaning send him to jail, hold him accountable. I'm not sure. But again, I'm not surprised. It's sort of like you're shocked, but you're not shocked because we watch this in real time. The one thing about Donald Trump, he allowed our imaginations to go wild, because if you let them go wild, you actually kind of know what's happening. And this story, to my mind, is that situation of when reality catches up with your imagination.
He was publicly going after Adam Schiff. He was speaking right about him, tweeting about him, Eric Swalwell. I mean, these are, but to be using your Justice Department, the Justice Department that belongs to the American people, this way.
Look, I would hope if proof is found that he directly ordered the Attorney General to do these things, then absolutely he should be held accountable. But I just don't see it happening at this point right now, given what we know.
Well, one thing's for sure, we are thrilled that the two of you are here in the studio, and I know everybody watching is too. Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks.
Great.
Thank you.
Good to be
with you both. Really good to see you both.